our last lesson of 1 Samuel, we concluded the episode in David's life where Abigail interceded in her husband Nabal's fight with David by convincing David that he should not take vengeance into his own hands. Now, God is David's avenger, and surely he will act to punish Nabal for his lack of charity, for his disrespect shown to God's anointed Nagid, king in waiting. David relented, and the scriptures make it clear that it was in David's best interests that he left that matter in the Lord's hands. Had he not, he would have committed the sin of blood guilt, unjustifiable killing of a man, homicide. And while there is no way for us to know for certain, it's likely, very likely, that this would have derailed David's opportunity to even be the king of Israel. Because the sin of blood guilt is among the worst possible trespasses against the Lord. And there is no atonement available for that. Hear me. In the law, there was no atonement available for that. You're stuck with it. Would God have allowed that kind of a man who's committed that sin to replace an already failed king? It's highly questionable. And sure enough, in a matter of but days, Nabal had a stroke and he died. Now, while the verses don't specifically say that Nabal's death was Jehovah avenging David, it is made clear that Nabal's death was certainly perceived as being a divine act. David felt it was God's justice at work. And yet, what exactly was Nabal's crime? So far as we know, it was primarily insulting David, acting without charity, perhaps behaving unfairly, at least according to the customs of that era. But even acknowledging that Nabal was a godless fool, as attested by his own name, there appears to be no direct violation of Torah law, certainly nothing worthy of capital punishment. So the question is, was Nabal's death directly for the purpose of avenging David? Answer, I doubt it. Nabal was just a wicked, an unsavory man, and apparently the Lord determined that his death would serve kingdom purposes more than his continuing to live. Now, I can assure you that if this happened today, it would be said that while coincidental to the conflict with David, that Nabal died of natural causes. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away life at his own good pleasure. It is never out of serendipity, but it can be for reasons that are rarely apparent to the living. Think about Job. His puzzling over his many calamities, of his friends who were, well, they were certain they knew the causes. And then finally, the story reveals that God in heaven was doing battle with Satan concerning Job. And so Job's troubles essentially had little to do with something Job did or didn't do. See, this is an attribute of God that is among the most mysterious and bothersome and difficult to accept, and yet it's so. Knowing a good thing when he saw one, David sent messengers to Nabal's widow, Abigail, and he asks her to become his wife. She immediately agrees, and the same passage at the end of chapter 25 tells us two other things about David's marital status. First, he married another woman, as well as Abigail. Her name was Ahinoam. Ahinoam. And second, King Saul spitefully took David's first wife, Michal, and gave her as a wife to another man, Altiel. And since there was no divorce by David of Michal, essentially Michal was married to two men simultaneously. Now, whether Saul's rash act was the result of getting word of David's two new wives and then being offended by it, or it was just a way of severing official familial connections with David, we don't know the answer to that. It matters not, for the effect was the same. All hope now, because of what had transpired here, all hope of reconciliation between David and Saul was dead. So, as of the end of 1 Samuel chapter 25, David technically had three wives: Michal, Ahinoam, and Abigail. Practically speaking, he had only two, but the two he had were as much about politics as was his original bride. Ahinoam and Abigail were from two different and important clans of the tribe of Judah. David's marriage into these clans built up goodwill, and it gave him access and influence then with these three powerful clans within the tribe of Judah. And when counting his own clan, the clan of Yishai, Jesse, he had a lot of influence now within Judah. This was going to help pave his way for his eventual coronation to be king of Judah. Well, let's pick up now David's story in 1 Samuel chapter 26. We'll read it all. 1 Samuel chapter 26. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 328. The people from Ziph went to Shaul and Geba and said, "David's hiding himself on the Hakalah hill across from Yeshimon." And then Saul set out and went down to the Ziph desert with 3,000 men chosen from Israel to search for David in the Ziph desert. And Saul pitched camp on Hakalah hill across from Yeshimon near the road. David was staying in the desert, and he saw that Shaul was coming into the desert after him. So David dispatched spies and determined that Saul had definitely come. David set out and went to where Saul had pitched his camp, and he saw where Saul and Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army, were sleeping. And Saul was lying inside the barricade with the troops asleep all around him. And David said to Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, "Who'll go down with me to Saul in the camp?" And Abishai said, "I'll go down with you." So David and Abishai went to the soldiers by night. Saul was lying there asleep inside the barricade. His spear was stuck in the ground next to his head, with Abner and the troops asleep all around him. Abishai said to David, "God has handed your enemy over to you today, so now please let me pin him to the ground with just one stroke of the spear. I won't even need to strike him a second time." But David said to Abishai, "Don't destroy him. Nobody can raise his hand against God's anointed without becoming guilty." David then added, "As Adonai lives, Adonai will strike him down, or the day will come for him to die, or he'll go down to battle and be swept away. Adonai forbid that I should raise my hand against Adonai's anointed. But now we'll take the spear by his head and the jug of water and get out of here." So David took the spear and the water jug from Saul's head and got away. And nobody saw or knew anything about it. No one awoke because they were all asleep, a deep sleep from Adonai had fallen over them. David crossed to the other side and climbed to the top of the distant ridge, leaving a considerable space between them. And then David called out to the troops and to Abner, the son of Ner, "Abner, aren't you going to answer?" And Abner answered, "Who are you calling to the king?" And David said to Abner, "Aren't you the brave one? Who is there in Israel to compare with you? So why haven't you kept watch over your lord the king? Someone came in to kill the king, your lord. That's not good, what you've done. As Adonai lives, you deserve to die, because you didn't keep watch over your lord Adonai's anointed. Now, see where the king's spear is. See where the jug of water that was next to his head." Joel recognized David's voice and said, "Is that your voice, my son David. And David said, it is my voice, my Lord King. And he continued, why is my Lord chasing his servant? What have I done? What evil am I planning? Please now, may my Lord the King hear what his servant is saying. If it's Adonai who has stirred you up against me, let him receive an offering. But if it's human beings, then a curse on them before Adonai. Because as things stand today, they've driven me out so that I can no longer share in Adonai's inheritance. They've said, go serve other gods. Now don't let my blood fall on the ground away from the presence of Adonai. The king of Israel has gone out in search of a single flea, as if he were hunting partridges in the mountains. And then Shaul said, I've sinned. Come back, my son David. I won't harm you any longer because you regarded my life as precious today. Yes, I behaved like a fool. I was altogether in the wrong. And David answered, here is the king's spear. Send one of your men over to bring it back. Adonai will give every person a reward suited to his uprightness and faithfulness. Adonai put you in my power today, but I would not raise my hand against Adonai's anointed. Look, just as I put great value on your life today, so may my life be given great value by Adonai. May he deliver me from every kind of trouble. And Saul answered David, blessings on you, my son David. No question that you will accomplish everything you set out to do. So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. Well, here we find David in an all too familiar situation. Saul was once again in pursuit of him and his men. Now, it didn't take long for this anti-king to forget and to rationalize away his tearful words to David, as recorded in 1 Samuel chapter 24, when Saul told David that surely David was God's anointed king. He was worthy of the position. Saul was so certain of David's rise to the throne and Jehovah's hand in it that he asked him, if you'll recall, to promise that he wouldn't kill Saul's children and descendants, but rather would show them kindness when he becomes king. And since David's going to be the focus of our study for months on end, I'd like to make a couple of comments. As I was looking at what various Hebrew sages and Christian commentators thought about this ongoing transition from Saul to David, and whether we can count on the accuracy of the scriptures in this regard, there were some pretty startling conclusions. Now, while rabbis and Hebrew scholars tend to make David as nearly flawless and thus have no real problem with the scriptures as written, except to fancifully explain away David's faupas, the more liberal Christian scholars, the disciplines of higher literary criticism, their approach to Bible study has always been that what we read in Samuel regarding David is more propaganda than divine truth. That essentially what we're reading here is a lot of after-the-fact rewriting of history by those who were loyal to David in order to make David look good. And thus, to accomplish this, Saul had to appear, unfairly in their eyes, as a supervillain. Now, early on in our study of 1 Samuel, I explained that we need to view Saul as a type of anti-king or anti-Christ, as opposed to David as being a type of God-anointed Messiah. And that this was a pattern that was going to persist right on through Revelation. And I say unapologetically that Saul ought to be viewed about the same way we view Hitler or even Lucifer. Here, however, is the view of Otto Fenius, a leading Christian commentator from Germany, writing in the mid-1800s when Germany was the center of modern Christian biblical exegesis and doctrinal development. Those views remain the prominent views within Christianity in our day. Here then is Theneus's view on King Saul. He says this: now Saul would have been a moral monster, which he evidently was not, if he had pursued David with quiet deliberation and through the medium of the same persons and had sought his life again after his own life had been so magnanimously spared by David. Now, I hope you caught the essence of Theneus's thinking on this matter, because he represents a very common approach to analyzing Holy Scripture since the late 1700s. And it is that certain Bible passages aren't considered trustworthy if an intellectual Bible scholar feels that they have a better solution. This is the same approximate period that the modern allegorical method of approaching the Bible also erupted, a method that dominates the institutional church today. The thinking is that Saul couldn't possibly have been all that bad, because no human could have been so mean or morally depraved as to have their own life spared and then determined to kill the person who spared it. Therefore, the only logical conclusion for an intelligent person is that the scripture is faulty. It's corrupt. And instead, we need to see Saul more sympathetically. We need to see David as significantly less approved by God than what we actually read. We need to give Saul and David a better, more even balance. And of course, this view is embedded in what is written and taught on the matter for the last two centuries. Not only is there no evidence to back up that kind of a view, but rather revolves only around a learned scholar's personal views and agenda, but such a view has done great violence to the Bible itself. Because if we're going to pick and choose which parts we're going to believe and which parts we're going to discredit or even discard, then what credence can we give to any of it? The narrative of 1 Samuel chapter 26 now tells us of a second opportunity for David to end Saul's life and then accelerate, if he does that, by his own hand, his rise to the throne of Israel. And David refuses this opportunity again. And verse 1 explains that the residents of Ziph again betrayed David by going to Saul and informing him about David's whereabouts. Why the leaders of Ziph are so adamantly against David, one can only speculate. Saul took 3,000 soldiers with him, as he had before when seeking David, and left immediately. And in the earlier incident, when the members of Ziph came to Saul with similar intelligence, the king was grateful, but not convinced that the men of Ziph actually knew where David was. So he asked them to verify it and then report back. Saul was not going to send 3,000 men again on another expedition without some kind of assurance. It turned out that the men of Ziph were correct, even though after Saul had surrounded David, he had to withdraw because the Philistines took that opportunity now to invade Israel. So this time, when the men of Ziph came to him concerning David's location, he believed them. And so he responded without hesitation. Well, when Saul and his troops arrived, this wilderness area that surrounds Ziph, they camped by the road that led up to the hill of Hakilah, where apparently David and his men were residing. His spies spy Saul's army. They inform David, and David sends more spies to reconnoiter. And once David got the surveillance information that he sought, he waited until an opportune moment, and then he snuck up on the encampment at night. And he saw that Abner, the supreme commander of Saul's army, had come along with Saul this time, and that Saul was sleeping in this protected area with soldiers all around him. And Abner was nearest to Saul, acting like his personal bodyguard. And in verse 6, David asks among his most trusted men who would go with him down to this enemy camp, and this fellow named Abishai volunteers. And we're told that Abishai, which means my father is Yishai or Jesse, was the son of Zeruiah, the brother of Joab. And as we might expect, Abishai was a close relative of David because it was customary and it was a lot safer to have your closest inner circle consisting of family members who, by the way, have a lot to gain by seeing you stay healthy. Thus, the name Abishai lets everyone know that he's part of David's father, Jesse's clan. Zeruiah was Jesse's daughter, David's sister. So Abishai was David's nephew. It's all in the family. Zeruiah was mother to Abishai, Joab, and Asahel. Abishai is commander of David's army. So naturally, it is he who can't refuse to go with David down to Saul's camp because the army commander is also the leader's chief protector. Now, why did David want to go down to Saul's camp? He changed his mind and now he wanted to confront Saul and finish him off? No, I'm sure that Abishai thought so. But David was still intent on proving his innocence to the king, as naive as all that might be. God bless those intentions, as risky and maybe unwise as they were. The men that were supposed to be guarding Saul not only fell into a sleep, but we're told a deep sleep. We're to understand that it was the Lord who induced them into the soundness of sleep such that the normally super aware warriors would stir at the sound of a stick cracking. But at this point, they were oblivious to David and Abishai's presence in their camp. Noiselessly, these two creep closer until they stand looming over the king himself. Saul's spear, which had become his scepter, his symbol of reign and authority, was stuck in the ground next to him, with Abner, Saul's chief general, just inches away from him. Abishai naturally concluded that as unlikely as it is that they could even get this close to the king and still be alive, it could only mean that the God of Israel had his hand in this, and now he's turned King Saul over to them finally for execution. And in verse 8, Abishai essentially says, "Let me do it. I want to do it. I didn't bring the spear along for nothing." But he says that using Saul's own spear, he'd kill him in one stroke. There won't be need for a second stroke. But David stays Abishai's hands and he tells him not to destroy Saul because nobody can raise his hand against God's anointed king without becoming guilty himself. For David, Saul is still the king, the rightful God-appointed king. And he can't bring himself to have Saul killed because he sees that this would be an affront to God. And he goes on to say that if Adonai wants to kill him, or Saul gets killed in battle, that's another matter. But David's not going to kill him. He's not going to have him killed. In fact, David is probably saying that it is certain that Saul will be killed at the Lord's hand in the Lord's timing. He's undoubtedly thinking back to what happened to Nabal. And when David tells Abishai to not destroy Saul, it is a little different than saying, "Don't kill him." The Hebrew is al tashiteu, and it means to mutilate. It means to deface. It means to corrupt. And the idea is that while killing the king would bring on the sin of blood guilt, there is also another sin piled on if one would kill the king in a way that disgracefully disfigures him, because that's just something you just don't do to a king. Actually, the statement mostly represents the customs of the times when even an enemy king is seen above most mortals, so he has to be accorded special privileges even in his death. Well, instead, the two men abscond with Saul's spear and his water canteen as proof of their presence, and then they leave as stealthily as they arrive. And once they were sufficiently far away so they wouldn't be captured, David shouts towards Saul's camp, and the bleary-eyed soldiers awaken to their embarrassment. And David specifically calls out Abner's name. Of course, that was to humiliate him. Using unrestrained sarcasm, David wants to know how it is that Saul's highest officer, his supposed best warrior, has allowed the enemy to literally stand over his king, able to kill him in an instant, and neither Abner nor his soldiers were aware of it. And he holds up the king's spear and his personal water jug as proof of his claim. Now, by all rights, Abner and his men should be ordered executed by the king for being derelict in their duty to guard him. It's the first duty of all soldiers to protect their king at all costs. They have failed. Saul awakens amid all this shouting and all this confusion. He hears a familiar voice. He asks rhetorically if this is his son, David. David confirms it, and Abner is stunned, humiliated. So he's silent as the king inquires after David, and David responds by politely and submissively asking for permission to speak. And David's still searching for the cause of this irrational hatred of Saul against him. So he tells the king that if it's God who has instigated this conflict, then they should make an offering to God in hopes that he'll reverse course and then take away Saul's anger. What David actually says, may God ruach mincha. It literally means, may God smell the smoke of a sacrifice. We discussed in our study of the book of Leviticus how the smoke of the offering was seen as all important, because the idea was that the smoke wafted up to the heavens where God would smell it. And he'd be appeased because it meant that his people were being obedient to his commandments and making their sacrifices of atonement. The bottom line is that if Saul's paranoia has been brought about by God as some sort of a punishment, then may the Lord show mercy. But if this is just the wicked inclinations of men at work, may they be cursed. Well, the last part of verse 19 expresses at least part of David's concern for himself. It is that he's been driven out. So he no longer has any part of the Lord's inheritance. What does that mean? No longer part of the Lord's inheritance. Do you remember what the Lord's inheritance is as concerns Israel and the Israelites? What is it? It's the land. That's their inheritance. Every Hebrew's inheritance was the land of Canaan. So David is saying that because of this irrational, this unjust war upon him, he has now been denied the ability to live peacefully within the promised land. Thus, those who are doing this to him are essentially telling David, go and worship other gods. What has exile from the promised land got to do with worshiping other gods? See, we're dealing with an ancient superstition that still held that gods are territorial. And David and Saul believed that. Each nation had its own gods. And when you crossed a national boundary into another country, you left one set of gods behind and you came into the sphere of influence of the gods of that territory you just entered into. So if David was unable to live in Israel, Saul was after him, then he would have no choice but to live in some other nation and worship that nation's gods, since Jehovah had no influence anywhere but Israel. That was the thinking. So for Saul to unjustly chase one of God's chosen out of his own inheritance and away from God's presence actually amounted to a capital offense against the God of Israel, who owns the land of Israel and rules over them through a king. So David is saying he certainly didn't want to die outside of Israel, away from God's presence. And even this had to do with the ancient mindset of ancestor worship and what happens after you die. Well, the last few words of verse 20 lose their meaning when translated into English. Those words say that the king of Israel is chasing a worthless man, as though he was hunting partridge. Actually, there was some very memorable wordplay going on here. And let me see if I can explain it in a brief fashion. The Hebrew word for partridge is hakore. Hakore. And it literally means the collar. So here we have David standing on a mountain calling to Abner and to Saul. And he parallels Saul's chasing after him to the hunting of the collar, partridges. And in verse 14, Abner says, Mi'atah hore? Or who is it that calls? Or most literally, oh, who are you, O caller? So David turns the tables and he mocks Abner's words by referring to himself as hakore, the caller. I'm David, the caller, the hakore. David says that he is the calling bird. He's a partridge who's being hunted in the mountains by Saul and Abner. Now, remembering that this story, like all other stories in the Bible, was handed down by word of mouth for generation after generation before it was evidently written down, we get this interesting wordplay that makes it easy to remember. It was undoubtedly a highlight of the story of this adventure, and no doubt it had to bring on laughter from the audience as they sat around a campfire retelling this story to one another. Well, reminiscent of their encounter in Ein Gedi, Saul turns all mushy on David, and he calls him his son, and he pleads with him to come on home to the king's palace, right? He promises he's not going to do any evil to David anymore. And that once again, David has proven his loyalty by sparing Saul's life. David has figured out that Saul's words mean nothing. So basically, his response just ignores Saul's offer. David instead offers to return the king's spear, which is essentially Saul's royal scepter. And he tells Saul to send one of his soldiers to come over and fetch it. David's come to grips, even though only maybe momentarily, with the heavenly reality that our reward, boy, this is important, our reward for righteousness and faithfulness does not come from other men. It comes from God. Now, while it ought to be reasonably expected in this situation that Saul would return good for good, in reality, the only guarantor of receiving a blessing for our righteous behavior is God in heaven. And that may not even come in this life, maybe later. This foundational but critical God principle is found in the New Testament in a number of forms. For instance, Matthew 6, 1 through 4. Be careful not to parade your acts of tzedakah, righteousness, goodness, mercy, in front of people in order to be seen by them. Because if you do, you'll have no reward from your Father in heaven. So when you do tzedakah, good deeds, don't announce it with trumpets to win people's praise like the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets. Yes, I tell you, they have their reward already. But when you do good deeds, don't even let your left hand know what your right hand's doing. Then your tzedakah will be in secret, your Father, who sees what you do in secret, will reward you. Romans 2:7 says, to those who seek glory and honor and immortality by perseverance in doing good, he will pay back with eternal life. Saul has the final word. He actually bestows a blessing, a beracha, upon David, and says that whatever David undertakes, he's surely going to achieve. The two men parted, and in life, they will never see each other again. This is it. Soon, just as the Lord took care of matters with Nabal, he was going to take care of matters with Saul. And David would avoid any blood on his hands, at least as far as dealing with Saul. But the reality is that heroes are some of the most flawed men on this planet. And David is chief among them. This is going to be very well demonstrated now in the next chapter. So turn your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 27. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, that's page 329. But David said to himself, one day Saul will sweep me away. Best thing for me to do is to escape into the territory of the Philistines. And then Saul will give up trying to find me here and or there in Israel's territory, and at last I'll be free of him. So David set out with his 600 men, and he passed on to Achish, the son of Maok, king of Gath. David lived with Achish, he and his men, each man with his household, including David with his two wives, Ahinoam from Yisrael and Abigail from Carmel, Nabal's widow. Saul was told that David had escaped to Gath, whereupon he stopped searching for him. Well, David said to Achish, if you're now favorably disposed towards me, let me have a place to live in one of the cities in the countryside. Why should your servant live in the royal city with you? That very day, Achish gave him Ziklag, and that is why to this day Ziklag belongs to the kings of Judah. After David had been living in the country of the Philistines for a year and 4 months, he and his men began going up and raiding the Geshuri, the Gisri, and the Amaleki. From ancient times, these people had lived in the land in the direction of Shur all the way to Egypt. David would attack the land, leaving alive neither men nor women, but taking the sheep and cattle, donkeys, camels, and clothing, and then he'd return and go to Achish. And Achish would ask, where are you raiding today? And David would answer, against the Negev of Judah, or against the Negev of Yerachmieli, or against the Negev of the Kenai. And the reason David spared neither men nor women to be brought to Gath is that he thought, we don't want them telling on us, saying David did so-and-so. That's how he conducted his raids for as long as he lived in the country of the Philistines, and Achish believed him. He said, David has caused his own people Israel to despise him utterly. He'll be my servant forever. Here's a chapter that shoots holes in liberal theologians' theories that most of the book of Samuel was written as propaganda to validate David's dynasty replacing Saul's. No writer or editor whose goal was to make David seem worthy, let alone perfect, would justify his position by including what we just read in Samuel 27, 1 Samuel chapter 27. If ever there was a time when David had the blood of innocence just dripping from his hands, and when his mouth was contorted with lies and deceptions, this is the one. But I think as we delve into this episode, you're going to see that it might even be worse than it appears at first glance. Something has shifted in David's thinking. It may have been that the encounter we read back in chapter 26 out in the Ziph wilderness, but it was probably equally as much that Saul had viciously, dishonorably given David's wife Michal to another man. It's hard to put into words the extreme injury and insult to David's honor that occurred with that act. Nonetheless, David no longer believed he could remain in Judah. So David concluded that Saul was going to hound him until one or the other of them was dead. So David took the drastic step of once again going to the Philistines, and he went back to the same place, Gath, where he had feigned insanity, but only a few years earlier, to survive. But there's a difference. David first went to Gath as a lone fugitive. He was looking for sanctuary, for mercy. He was rejected. This time, he went as the leader of a substantial mercenary army. And he had something to offer. He could offer services to the king of Gath in return for a good living and for protection from King Saul. At least the king of Gath would divide and conquer, so to speak, by allowing David to come and stay. David was probably the single most influential force now within the tribe of Judah and therefore within the territory of Judah. There is little chance that any clan of Judah would now give their full loyalty to Saul, a leader of the northern coalition of Israelites' tribes. So Achish undoubtedly figured that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Even if he didn't fully trust David, David was Saul's mortal enemy, and that was pretty useful for the Philistines. Judah would be more cooperative with the Philistines, with David as an ally and as a resident, so they could focus their military assets on the remainder of Israel up in the north. Well, it seems that this time, Achish welcomed David, and he housed David and all of his small army in the city of Gath as his royal guests. And it's clear that David's two wives, Ahinoam and Abigail, went with him. And when Saul heard of what happened, he just abandoned his pursuit of David, just like David hoped he would. Well, some time passes, and verse 5 has David approaching the king of Gath and asking to be given territory of his own rather than continuing living under Achish's nose. Well, Philistine territory was, of course, what he had in mind. And what we find is that David has essentially become a favored vassal to the Philistine king as Achish grants him this request. Now, this is not at all unlike the feudal system of old in Eastern Europe. David supplies military assistance to the king, and in return, the king grants David some territory he can lord over and have a little more independence. Now, no doubt, for Achish, it made sense to give David a little space. It could not have looked good for this foreigner with his own army, loyal only to David, to live in the capital city of their supposed master. Moving them out to the countryside, well, that solved that problem. But it also removed the rather irksome restraints that David would have been under for obvious political reasons. So we see in verse 6 that very day, meaning Achish didn't have to think about David's request for very long, the city of Ziklag was assigned to David. It was a logical choice, as Ziklag previously belonged to Judah, but now was under Philistine control. But even being considered part of Judah was a recent development. Ziklag was originally assigned by Moses and Joshua to the tribe of Simeon. That it became part of Judah demonstrates something we've discussed before. It is that in a tribal system, there is no end to each tribe attempting to increase their influence and to become the most dominant tribe in the region. Already during Saul's reign, the tribe of Simeon was substantially absorbed by the tribe of Judah. This was not accomplished by pleasantry. It was accomplished by tribal warfare. By the time David died, and then his son Solomon took over, Simeon essentially all but disappeared as a separate tribal entity, and the people and the territory of Simeon became rolled into Judah. Now we're going to stop here for tonight. We're going to continue with David's time in Philistia next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.